Well, hey there, vinyl record collectors. I'm here to tell you about the best record cleaner I've ever used, the Groove Washer. Go to groovewasher.com and get yourself a vinyl record cleaning kit. They start around $20, but the bundles are where you really save. The Groove Washer G2 Fluid is the best on the market. And whether you're a hobbyist with 20 records or less, or a maniac like me with overflowing shelves at home, the Groove Washer has record cleaning bundles that will fit for any record collector. Even if you have an automatic rotating vacuum record cleaning machine, you need cleaning fluid, and the Groove Washer G2 Fluid is perfect for that. Head over to groovewasher.com today, and guess what? Here's a 10% off discount code, VinylGuide10. Use VinylGuide10 at checkout and save 10% off anything at groovewasher.com. Groovewasher.com ships worldwide and proud to be made in the USA.
Oh, this is Bruce Spicer talking with the Vinyl Guide about the Beatles' infamous Butcher cover.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to the Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of the Vinyl Guide. Thanks for downloading, thanks for listening, and thank you in advance for sharing it on your social media. Putting it on your Facebook, tweeting it on Twitter, putting it on Instagram. It's all very helpful and appreciated here. And it's a great day outside. I can hear the birds chirping, and we have an awesome episode waiting for you. This week on the Vinyl Guide, we are talking all about the history of the Beatles Butcher cover, the centerpiece of the collection of many record collectors, including myself. I just got a Butcher cover last year, and it's pretty breathtaking to see and finally hold one after hearing about them all these years. This album has such great music, and it's from a transitory period, a time of growth and maturity for the biggest music band in history, yet the music, at least for some time, was quite overshadowed by the cover art and the drama that unfolded because of it. Now, for years, most music fans and collectors didn't know the full story of the Butcher cover. The Beatles themselves rarely spoke about it, and when they did, often their quotes were not circulated widely, so it left many people guessing. And, of course, the record company, Capitol Records, certainly wasn't going to tell the tale of the Butcher cover very loudly, as it was a major misstep for them and ended up costing them hundreds of thousands of dollars to correct, which is not something they were keen to relive or shout from the rooftops. However, we now have the full story of the Beatles Butcher cover, and today on the show we have the very best guy in the world to tell that story, Bruce Spicer, Beatles historian and author of multiple books on the Beatles and their vinyl record history. Now, if you're not familiar with Bruce's work, I urge you to go to Beatle.net and check out some of his books. They are the authoritative tomes on the Beatles' vinyl record pressing history. They have both hardcover and digital versions, which you can be enjoying within minutes. And I must share, Bruce's Beatles books are fantastic. They're high-gloss pages, nice printing, and the digital versions have high-resolution photos, so you could pinch in and out of the images and get the detail on the fonts of the various record labels. I truly do recommend Bruce's books. Check them out at Beatle.net. He's just announced a new one on Let It Be, so you could pre-order that now, and I'm sure it's as fascinating as all the rest of Bruce's books. That is available at Beatle.net. And if you enjoy the conversation with Bruce today, there are several other Beatles episodes we have that you can enjoy afterward at thevinylguide.com, including episode 179, The Story of Abbey Road, again featuring Bruce Spicer, discussing the environment, the recording, the pressing of the landmark album Abbey Road. That's episode 179 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 146, Bruce again came on the show to talk about the Beatles' White Album and the formation and confusing launch of Applecore Label and Company. That's episode 147 of The Vinyl Guide. And the first time Bruce was on The Vinyl Guide show was episode 63, talking all about the early records of the Beatles in the USA on the VJ record label, which was very interesting since the very small VJ label lucked out and got the rights to make records for the Beatles, who would soon become a global sensation. The whole story is episode 63 of The Vinyl Guide, The Beatles on VJ Records. And if you like Butcher covers, you will absolutely love the story of John Lennon's personal copy of the Butcher cover, as told by its original owner, Dave Morrell. The story of John Lennon's Butcher cover on episode 57 of The Vinyl Guide, and even more John Lennon craziness, episode 31, the story of John Lennon's worst-selling album, Roots, a TV mail order debacle that is a strange, strange story, and now a serious collectible. That's episode 31 of The Vinyl Guide. All episodes are available at thevinylguide.com to listen to anytime. You could, of course, use Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever app you use to get these shows. And that's it for the upfronts. Let's get into today's episode with Bruce Spizer, Beatles historian and author. His books are available at beatle.net. And today, let's hear all about the story of the Beatles Butcher cover. This week on The Vinyl Guide, I'm very pleased to welcome back our friend of the show, Bruce Spizer, Beatles historian who has written extensively about the Fab Four. You can see and order physical and digital copies of his books at beatle.net. Bruce, how many books do you have now?
I have 11 books that I've completed, and I'm working on number 12, which I hope to have out in the fall, dealing with the Get Back, Let It Be album. And I'm looking forward to getting that one done. It's book's going along nicely, so I've made substantial progress on it.
I see you've had a lot of time at home the last few weeks, so hopefully that will play right into the strengths of getting this book done.
Yes, I'm confident as long as we don't run into issues with the the printer or things like that. So. Mm-hmm. But we are hoping to have the book out possibly as early as September.
Oh, wonderful. All right. Well, come back when that is ready to go. Look, Bruce, your books are fascinating. They're full of beautiful pictures. And for the record collectors, I think these are must-haves. Beautiful stories and images of the variations of Beatles vinyl. They're informative. A lot of facts around the records, which we love. And truly, I cannot think of a more authoritative source of information on Beatles vinyl, which is why it's natural that I turn to you for this conversation I've wanted to have for quite some time. The story of the Butcher cover, which it's equal parts bizarre, adventuresome, and rarity for vinyl collectors. So I think most people know the high-level story. The Beatles had a photo shoot. They got really adventurous, decided to use that cover for an American release when many were printed, then destroyed, making the remaining ones exceedingly rare and expensive. It goes much more complex than that, doesn't it, Bruce?
Yeah, and let's why don't we first get the myths out the way, and then we'll do what really happened.
Sure.
The myths are that the Beatles were very frustrated with the way Capitol treated their record catalog, that Capitol had butchered the Beatles. And John, being the adventurous one, got this idea that they would have their pictures taken in butcher smocks with meat. And the idea was, we will visually show Capitol butchered the Beatles. Ha, ha, ha. And the Beatles go ahead and direct the photographer to take these pictures. And then they send it to Capitol and insist that Capitol use it as a cover. Capitol is not aware that they're being insulted by this. They go ahead and they do the cover. And then all of a sudden, people, are all upset with the cover. So Capitol says, look, we need a different cover. You guys got to send us another picture. So the Beatles get together, and they couldn't be bothered to do anything elaborate. So they sit around a steamer trunk. If you look at their faces, you can see how disappointed they are that the butcher cover isn't going to be used. And they send the photo picture of the butcher, of the trunk session. And now we have the trunk cover. And so, we went from the butcher to the trunk cover. And that is wrong. Mm. What the real thing that happened, and, everyone says, well, it's obvious, it was butcher trunk. Wrong. The order was trunk, butcher, trunk. I know some of your listeners are going, well, wait, that doesn't make any sense, Bruce. So, look, why don't we, out of The Sound of Music, let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. And so we're going to go ahead and do that, and we're going to go back in time until April 29, 1966. And the Beatles are going to have a photo session with Bob Whitaker. Bob Whitaker was an interesting type of person. He had done work with the Beatles before, and he kind of liked to do things of a little bit of a different type nature. He started out with really basic things, and then he got into these theme ideas. And for a photo shoot, and it was actually used on a Beatles album, Beatles 65, he got the idea then in late 64 to have a session of the Beatles as if they were the Four Seasons. Not the musical group, the Four Seasons, but winter, spring, summer, fall. And so these pictures were taken with the Beatles in various different poses to show each of the seasons. They might be wearing a coat for winter, or, you know, or an umbrella, winter showers, you know, and the whole bit like that, and raking the leaves in the fall. So you had these different things. And so he liked those ideas. So for this session, he took some basic things. They needed some publicity photos, so he took a few simple publicity photos. And then it was, okay, well, let's do something a little bit different. So he took a picture of Paul holding a question mark sign. And then he had the idea of, let's take some pictures with George's head in a birdcage and Paul holding up the birdcage. The idea, you know, being that the Beatles sang like canaries. You know, let's take one with, you know, and so that was done. And then he had a cardboard box that he opened up and wrote on one of the flaps, 2 million, and had John hold it around Ringo's head to show that Ringo was one of 2 million people in the world, just like you and me. So no big deal there. Then it got really weird. He handed George a hammer and some nails and asked him if he could pretend that he was hammering nails into John's head. And apparently the purpose of that was to show that John was human like you or me, and if you hammered a nail into his head, he would bleed. And so that was done. And then things got, you know, really, you know, I mean, it was just going on like that. And so now they had this meat that he had ordered and some butcher smocks and baby dolls. And the next thing you know, he has, and he was inspired. There was this book called Die Puppy, a German book by Hans Bellmer, and the translation was The Doll. And in it, it showed very convoluted dolls and weird positions and missing pieces and parts. So he took some pictures of the Beatles sitting on the floor playing with doll parts. They cut off the heads or the legs, and it was just very strange. And the next thing was, well, you know, let's have some sausages. And the Beatles had their picture taken with a woman facing them, and she was attached to, apparently, to her stomach, although you can't see it in the picture, with these sausages that looked like an umbilical cord. And the camera was taken behind her, showing the Beatles, John, holding these sausages. And the idea was this was the birth of the Beatles. Well, that was pretty bizarre. And then he got the idea of something which he called a somnambulant adventure. What does somnambulant mean? Kind of a dreamlike state. So what he did was he had the Beatles put on these butcher smocks, and John and Paul and Ringo sat on a chair, and George stood behind him, and he placed slabs of beef on the three laps, and George held up two pieces of beef, and off camera he had two people hold slabs of beef, and the Beatles' eyes were closed. And he also put some eyes from the baby dolls on John's hand and some on one of the meat on Paul. And that picture was taken with their eyes closed. Very strange. And then he decided, okay, now let's mix in some baby doll parts. And he went ahead and did that too. Now, Bob Whitaker was not the only photographer taking pictures there. He had an assistant who also took pictures. And I think he took the black and white photos and Whitaker took the color. So that's why there are both color and black and white photos from the session. There also was a reporter from the Beatles book, Johnny Dean, and he brought a photographer with him, a guy who snapped some shots of the session, not so much the session itself, but taking pictures of Whitaker at work. And so that was kind of interesting because, you know, in Beatles book, you see pictures of Whitaker and his assistant standing on a stool taking a picture of the Beatles in simple portrait mode. But what's cool about that picture is if you look on the floor, you see this tin pan full of sausages and meat. So it's a really, really strange thing.
Did Whitaker have a plan for this? It sounds like a lot of just random things. The picture of the question mark, the sausages. I mean, how well thought out was this?
Whitaker claims that what he had in mind was an elaborate gatefold album cover where he was going to have a lot of these images used, but used differently. So in other words, you know, the Butcher cover or the Butcher picture was not going to be a cover in itself. It'd be a small part of various other things. And unfortunately, I don't think Whitaker during his life ever, you know, started, you know, just said, okay, this is what it would have looked like thing. You know, he was going to do all sorts of things, like he was going to thinking about putting, you know, halos around the Beatles and all kind of other stuff like that. Just really strange ideas. But this was never intended, the Butcher picture itself, to be in and of itself an album cover. So what happens is Whitaker has this session. Tony Barrow is there, the Beatles PR man, and he's absolutely horrified with these Butcher pictures. But he knows they will never see the light of day, so that's the good news, right? And you know, and what they really wanted out of the session was just a simple publicity shot of the four Beatles. And Whitaker did have that, and they did use it to promote the 1966 North American tour. It was the picture they distributed to the press of just the four Beatles, you know, together. Very, you know, very dull, boring shot, but what they needed. So anyway, you know, that's kind of the pictures are taken and the session's sort of forgotten about. And then all of a sudden, Brian is meeting with the boys who are getting ready to go on their tour to Germany. And, you know, they've been in the studio recording some songs, and they're going to be going to Germany. And so Brian gets the idea of, look, why don't you guys come by, because there's a reporter for a German magazine who would like to interview you, which will be great for the tour. So, you know, why don't you come on by and be interviewed by him? The magazine is Bravo, and the guy's name is Thomas Beyl, B-E-Y-L. And so the Beatles show up at Brian's office for the interview. And Brian says, look, you know, we can always use pictures of you guys. Whitaker's here. You know, how he's going to take your pictures. So what Bob does is, okay, well, what are we going to use? Oh, there's a steamer trunk. So they get the steamer trunk, and they turn it on its side, and they take a couple of different pictures. And, you know, one of the pictures that they take is a picture of Paul and John sitting inside the steamer trunk with Ringo and George behind it. Then they take a picture where they turn the trunk on its side, and Paul is in the trunk sitting inside, John sitting on top, Ringo's behind it looking like he's closing the lid, and George is on a riser standing behind them, towering over them. And those pictures get taken by Bob Whitaker. When I interviewed Whitaker, he told me that he felt those pictures were as important as the Butcher pictures. I don't know why he felt that way, but he did.
This seems very strange, especially in this particular time and age where dozens or even hundreds of photos are snapped off within a matter of minutes. So you're telling me the trunk cover session, first off, it sounds like it was impromptu. The Beatles weren't even expecting to have their picture taken. And then maybe half a dozen or so pictures were taken with that steamer trunk, of which we eventually get one for the cover.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually seen three different pictures from that photo session.
Okay.
Now, he obviously took more, but there are only three that I'm aware of that have seen the light of day. So any and all, after the session, Bob Whitaker shows them black and white prints from the Butcher session. And in the Capitol Albums digital book, not the print edition, but the digital one, because that came out later, I actually have pictures of George and Ringo looking at Butcher pictures, one of John looking at it. And then the most interesting one is there's a shot of Bob Whitaker showing excitement. And there's John with this big grin on his face looking at photos, which are obviously the Butcher pictures. And it's taken in Brian's office. And in the background, there is a framed picture of the Beatles cartoon show. And so, you know, you've got the cartoon Beatles in this, and then there's a shot of Paul with kind of a bemused almost look on his face, and Thomas Bell, the German reporter, looking at the Butcher pictures, the black and white ones. So that happens. And now Capitol Records, in the meantime, has informed Brian of, look, we're doing a new Beatles album. It's going to have some old songs that haven't been on albums yet. And, oh, by the way, could you get us a couple of tracks from the Beatles' current session? Because your albums have 14, ours only have 11, so we can use three of your songs, put it on that album and some other stuff, and we need a picture. So, you know, maybe that's why Brian had that impromptu photo session. Maybe he got that call from Capitol a day or two before. But the album title is going to have, you know, because it's got these songs that haven't been on albums, one of them is Yesterday. And so someone at Capitol gets the idea, we're going to call the album Yesterday and Today. And the initial layout for the album cover has Yesterday in quotes because it's the name of the song in quotes. So the album's going to be called Yesterday and Today. And Capitol has this picture that Brian sends him of the Beatles in a trunk. It has the full background. You can see the curtains in Brian's office. And their starting point, believe it or not, is the Yesterday single. Why do I say that? Because the Yesterday single at the top has a banner that has a blue background with the Beatles in white and the song titles in yellow. So how do they design the cover? They take the Yesterday picture, the trunk cover picture, I mean, and they put a banner on the left side. The banner is, guess what color it is? Blue. What color is the Beatles' name? It's in white. And what are all the song titles in? Yellow. Some people call it the purple trunk. It's really the blue trunk. And that is going to be the cover for Yesterday and Today. Period. End of story. And, but for Brian's intervention, that would have been the cover, and our conversation today would have been about 5 minutes long. However, the cover
Before we go there, how many of these slicks were printed of that original Yesterday and Today design?
We don't know, but about a half a dozen or so have come to light that appear to be genuine.
Oh, okay.
So we know that Queen's Litho did print some. Mm. Now, the album was going to come out on June 16th, so Capitol wanted to, you know, to start getting the cover slicks done. And before production began, Brian wanted to see the cover. I don't blame Brian. You know, hey, I want to see what it looks like. Brian gets the cover, and he looks at it, and he doesn't like it. Maybe what he didn't like about it were the colors of the curtain in his office in the background. Mm. They're kind of funky looking, and maybe Brian just thought, nah, I don't really like this design. So Brian told Capitol, look, see if you can come up with something better. So Capitol, in the meantime, decides they're going to come up with something different. And apparently they send Brian a mock-up of, look, we can just have the trunk cover, and we can cut away the background and have a white background album cover, and we can write Yesterday and Today on it. You know, will that work for you? So this mock-up is sent to Brian. It takes a few days for him to get it. And shortly after Brian gets the mock-up, the Beatles at this time, and I know this all sounds convoluted, but I've done a lot of research and the days fit. So work with me here, folks. The Beatles are doing a video session for their single Paperback Writer in Rain. And the video session takes place at Abbey Road on May 19th. And before the Paperback Writer video there, you can see Paul holding up a color transparency. And if you blow it up, it's a color transparency of a Butcher color photo. So bear in mind that on that day, Paul and the rest of the Beatles see the actual color Butcher cover pictures, transparencies. They'd only seen black and white earlier. The next day, they're doing a photo shoot at Chiswick Gardens. And here's where fate comes in. Brian has the white background Yesterday and Today trunk cover mock-up. and apparently the Beatles see it. And John, it's a boring thing. It's just a mock-up.
Right.
John doesn't think much of it. And John remembers what he saw the day before and says, look, I want that Butcher color image to be the cover of this album. And, of course, Brian is horrified by it. But Paul, oh, yeah, that's cool. And so John and Paul want that to be the album cover. And by this time, Brian is no longer making the decisions. The dynamics have changed. The Beatles, translated John and Paul, are making these types of decisions. And so Brian's marching orders, to his horror, are to send Capitol this image for the new cover. So Brian very, very reluctantly does this. And he sends it to Capitol, and it arrives at their art department. And George Osaki, head of the art department, is an artist type guy. And he sees this and, wow, this is great. And what we can do with this thing, you know, boy, I know what we can do. And he gets all excited about it. You know, we'll give it kind of this textured background and we'll do this. And they do a cover mock-up for it and show it to the sales force. Now, the sales force are trying to sell records. They want records to be displayed. And the sales force freaks out. Man, you can't do this. And so the sales force basically runs up to President Alan Livingston and says, Alan, we can't put this out. Alan looks at it and he says, you're right, we can't put this out. So Alan gets on the phone and calls their manager, Brian Epstein, and says, Brian, look, you know, we can't put this out in the States. There's no way we can put this out. Now, Brian agrees with Alan, but he can't say that because Brian's marching orders are this is to be the cover. So Brian tells Alan, no, the boys want this to be the cover. And Alan says, you know, what does this all mean? And basically Brian says it's their statement about war. Now, later on, John was quoted as saying, you know, in 1966, so pretty contemporaneous, I said that, you know, if Americans can accept the war in Vietnam, they can accept this cover. So, in fact, it was a statement about war. And John also said he wanted to break the group's image, you know, the Fab Four, you know, clean-cut kid image. Well, boy, that certainly would break an image.
Right.
Yeah, you got it. So Alan Livingston says, look, we'll see what we can do, Brian. And he calls in the production people and he says, look, why don't you go ahead and, you know, do a small number, a couple of hundred, and, you know, show them to people, get some opinion on it, and see whether we can really do this. Well, the production department is thinking, come on, Alan, you know, they don't tell this to Alan. He gets blindsided because their thinking is very simple. Look, we want to put this record out on June 15th. We need covers. And so damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, boom, you know, 800,000 to 1.2 million, whatever, Butcher Slicks are done, and they begin manufacturing the covers. And so the covers at this point in time, now we're in the month of June, and these covers are being manufactured. As best I can tell, the cover slicks were printed on June 2nd, and the actual album covers were fabricated between June 2nd and 4th, and they begin pressing the albums between June 4th and 7th.
So I understand also at this time there is a directive from Capitol Records to correct some errors that they've done in past Beatles releases, which is to have all the records in all the shops on the same day. Prior to that, yeah, I believe it was a bit spotty. So here they're actually going hammer and tongs to print up as many as possible and to ship them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, so they're really going ahead. So they go ahead and they actually, you know, send out the records for people to look at, you know, around the 7th or whatever of June. And the idea is the record's going to come out the following week. But they get to their just distribution places around, you know, that Thursday, Friday, whatever. In the meantime, the reviewers that get the cover just start calling the tower and bombarding the tower with, you know, you cannot put this out. Distributors are saying, the stores are telling us they won't put it in the stores. You know, we can't do this. You've got to stop. And so at this point in time, Alan Livingston calls up Brian and he says, look, can't do it. Not going to happen. And Brian reluctantly agrees. And so Capitol has Operation Recall. Now, we missed a step in here. And that is an important step. And, you know, when you're doing these long interviews, and we're a long way away, you know, you're way down under and I'm in New Orleans. So one of the things that happened was that they wanted to try one more shot to convince Brian not to do the Butcher cover. Now, bear in mind that Capitol originally knew they needed to do a different trunk design. And so Capitol began doing alternate trunk designs. And they actually did three alternate trunk designs. And these designs were done, and, you know, hoping that one of these would be acceptable to Brian. And Brian met with a representative of Capitol in New York. Brian was in New York doing some legwork for the U.S. tour. And Brian meets with him, and, you know, around the end of May, and they show him, oh, we have this design here, and we have this other design here. And then they had a really bizarre one where it actually took images, two images of the Beatles around the trunk. One was sideways and one was normal. And they show him those three designs. No, we want the Butcher. So Capitol already has some trunk designs ready. Now, for the Butcher cover design, George Osaki got a little bit creative in that. The photo inspired him to, rather than having block letters saying yesterday and today, he came up with this psychedelic-looking font. And so you see, if you look at the Butcher cover, it has that psychedelic font in the upper right corner, you know, the Beatles, yesterday and today. So that's there, but wasn't used. So now Capitol needs a new cover, and they need a new cover quickly. Well, George Osakwi thinks, you know, I like that psychedelic font I did. So Osaki's idea is, I'm going to take the black film layover. All it has on it is a Capitol logo, the song titles, The Beatles Yesterday and Today, that plaps in the upper right corner. And I'm going to take one of those trunk variations and get rid of the layovers for the ink and just have that trunk. I'm going to move it slightly to the left. And then that Beatles Yesterday and Today that I lifted off the trunk cover is going to fit right there. And let's try it with a silver background. They actually did one of those, and I actually own the prototype. And then they tried it with a white background. They decided to go with the white background. So now Capitol has a new cover design. And Operation Recall is in effect. Capitol sends letters out to the reviewers and says, hey, listen, that cover we sent you, the Beatles were showing a pop art satire that would have been fine in England, but because it might be misinterpreted, we're not going to put it out that way. And oh, by the way, please send us back that cover. Mm. Do you know how many people sent back those covers to Capitol?
About six.
Zero. Zero, actually, according to Alan Livingston. No one did. So they start Operation Recall. Well, what does that mean? Did the record actually go out on sale? Yeah. In very, very limited quantities. It was supposed to go out and sell the following week, but there's a store, Wallach's Music Center in Los Angeles. And the store is owned by someone who founded Capitol Records, and they used to get Beatle albums a little early. Imagine how that could happen. So it actually went for sale there for a couple of hours. They're also what we call rack jobbers, and these are people that would get records from distributors and put them in department stores, drug stores like TG&Y. Some of those guys didn't get the recall thing in time, and they actually placed them in drugstores. So some people might have actually been able to buy a Butcher cover in the United States that Friday, but they weren't on the shelves for long, and they were taken off. So now Capitol tells their employees, guess what you're going to be doing this weekend? You know, you are going to be opening boxes of albums that we've already sent to distributors. We're getting them back. And your job is to open it up, cut the shrink wrap with a box cutter, take the record and the sleeve out and put it in the corner over there, and take those covers and put them in the corner there. And oh, by the way, if you take one of those covers with you, you're fired. And so they make it very clear that these have to be done. And these covers are all going to be destroyed. And it's going to cost Capitol $250,000. And then someone at Capitol gets an idea. And he says, you know, this front cover slick's a problem. But those two pieces of cardboard, which are the biggest cost involved, ain't nothing wrong with the cardboard. Certainly nothing wrong with the back album slick that just lists the song titles. So what we can do is we can paste over these trunk slicks on top of the butcher cover. No one will be the wiser.
Now, was that a practice that was done before the butcher cover? Were there albums where they pasted over the front and or back cover to save cost?
Yeah. Sometimes they would have too many covers manufactured, and they would just go ahead and paste the cover slick over it if they could. If they could save it, why not?
Okay.
So, yes, that was done. So it wasn't totally unheard of, but here was the thing. It had never been done on that scale. Capitol used two different companies, and one of them was on board with the plan. They said, yeah, we can do that. And the other company said, no, we're not going to do that, because our concern is if we do that, there are two things that could happen that could go wrong. One is if we use glue that is too strong, the glue will bleed through the cardboard and will damage the vinyl. And if we use glue that is not strong enough, these suckers could come off, and you don't want that to happen. We refuse. And so one of the companies Capitol used said no, and one of them said yes. So Capitol decided that they would have the company that said they would do it, do it. And so they had these covers and the type of glue that they needed, and they had people put the glue and, you know, and just paste these on over and paste them on over. No one will ever be the wiser. And so when the record went on sale, and here's the key thing, if you went out and bought that record, there were two possibilities. One, you got a nicely, freshly minted trunk cover. Or if you were lucky, you got one of those paste overs. They all went on sale at the same time. And so what happened was the problem, remember I told you earlier that I had that silver prototype background? Well, I went with the white one. Well, the color white shows more bleed through than silver. And you could see Ringo's black shirt if you looked really, really carefully. And some Beatle fans had heard about the butcher cover, and, oh, look what's there. And so what did they do? They tried to steam off the cover with varying degrees of success. And so fans had these covers. They didn't look all that great, but they had the butcher cover. They could see it.
At this point, was it fairly well known that there was this butcher cover and there were paste over variations, so people even knew what to look for?
It depended on where you lived. I mean, it wasn't like anyone could tell you this is what you look for. Mm-hmm. But if you lived in Dallas, one of the Dallas radio stations on their survey showed, hey, this is what the cover was that got banned. And if you lived in Los Angeles, KRLA had a magazine they used to put out called KRLA Beat, and they showed the cover, not on the front cover, but they showed it. And so it was available to see. So, you know, those people knew about it. In New Orleans, I didn't know about it, but, you know, but there were people that knew about it. And mine was one of those nicely, freshly minted ones, so I wasn't one of the lucky ones. But I wouldn't have known in 1966 to look for it anyway.
How many of those pasteovers were there? I mean, we don't know exact numbers, but approximately how many pasteovers were there?
I am going to guess about 200,000 to 400,000. So I know what you're thinking. If that many were done, Butcher covers are not that rare. And you're absolutely right. It's called the world's most common rare record. Now, when I say butcher covers aren't that rare, I mean the ones that were pasted over are not that rare.
Right.
They're out there, folks. Now, the actual ones that were never pasted over are pretty rare because most of those covers were either destroyed or pasted over.
On that note, there are three states of a butcher cover. There's the first state, which is the butcher cover that was never pasted over, and those are exceedingly rare, I believe. Those are the ones that you either had to buy on that exact day, or you had to know a distributor or something, something to that effect.
Or you got a copy because you were a record reviewer, or you had a Beatles fan club.
Right.
Believe it or not, some of the presidents of the Beatles fan club were sent that butcher cover. Can you imagine the shock of those teenage girls getting that sucker?
Do we know how many of those first states exist, approximately?
Well, you figure from a promo standpoint, several hundred were done. That would be, clearly so. And then on the stereo, the stereos were not sent out for promo. So Alan Livingston had a box with about, I think, 20 mono and 5 stereo or some color, maybe 4 and 21 or whatever. The stereos are extremely rare because they were all supposed to be destroyed, quite frankly, but obviously they weren't. But and also stereo albums were done in lesser numbers than mono at that time, and that was about to change with Revolver and particularly Sgt. Pepper.
Mono to stereo, stereos were about 20% of the volume of mono. From what I understand, there were about a million.
By then, 20% is probably about right. It was 10% before then. Right. By then, it could have been up to 20%.
So just going back to the math here, we estimate probably about 250 paste overs, which are the second state. So the first state is the Beatles butcher that was never touched or pasted over. Then there's the second state, which is the paste over. And then the third state, which fans made for themselves by peeling off the trunk cover.
Right. And that's the terminology we use. And that's fine. We'll stick with it. I think it's, not all that accurate in a sense, but that's fine. We'll use it. And here's the thing. So I know a lot of your listeners might say, okay, are there a lot of peels? Yeah, a lot of them have been peeled. So the question is, to peel or not to peel? That is the question. And the answer that I always tell people is, take a look at what you have. If you've got a near mint paste over, leave it alone, because this is the way it was sold to people in 1966. Keep it as is. However, let's say that you're walking around and you see a little yard sale, and you go and in the boxes of the albums you see, and believe me, a friend of mine found 12 of them this way at yard sales. And they're priced a couple of dollars, because they don't know what it is or it wouldn't be in the box. And you take it home and you say, oh, my God, I can't believe I got away with it. I gave someone $3 for this, and now do I peel it or not? Well, if when you look at that album cover, it has on the front cover, Susie Smith. Well, okay, that's going to reduce its value. And suppose it's kind of scuffed up and all that other stuff. Well, if you got that professionally peeled and that slick was removed, what's under it's not going to have Susie Smith's name on it. It's going to look pretty darn good. So my rule of thumb is, if it's a really nice second state, please do not peel it. If it's a bad one, peel it. Ain't got nothing to lose.
So, from what I understand, there were multiple factories that did the manufacturing, and therefore there are multiple factories that have different levels of rarity and possibly even different glues, depending on where.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
Different glues, yes, as to where they were done. So, you have Los Angeles, you have Scranton, Pennsylvania, and you have Jacksonville, Illinois. And those are your three plants. And so depending on where the covers were reprocessed. If it's a paste over, some of the factories use a stronger glue, and those will be tougher to eliminate. And so, I know that Jacksonville, a lot of those covers were sent in a landfill. So Jacksonville, if my memory serves me well, Jacksonville paste overs are not all that common. And I think the Los Angeles ones are the ones that are tricky to peel. Now, I may be wrong on that. It's in the book. I haven't, I glanced through the book before the interview, but I didn't read every page in it. So, but there are variances, absolutely. Now, the most desirable capital butchers are what we call Livingston butchers. And by a Livingston butcher, I alluded to this before. Alan Livingston was president of Capital. Now, when this butcher fiasco happened, one of Livingston's officers of the company walked into Alan's office with a box containing, I think it was 21 mono in 4 stereo copies. And he said, "Alan, this is a box of a butcher cover." And Alan said, "Get that out of here. The last thing in the world I ever want to see is another butcher cover." And the employee said, "Alan, trust me, save him." And so Alan brought the box home and put it in his closet. And many, many years later, not that many years later, but years later, about a dozen or so years later or more, Alan Livingston's son was going to an event called Beetlefest in Los Angeles. And he asked his dad if he could bring some of those covers with him. And his dad said, "Sure, they're yours, whatever you want." And he brought them there, and most of the dealers there, those aren't real, nice try. And a couple of dealers were smart and bought them. Perry Cox bought a few. And the stereo ones, I think he sold one or two for $1,000. And then he realized, maybe I shouldn't be selling these at that price if people are paying that much that soon. And so he kind of stopped selling them. Then he got his father to prove that they were real, do an affidavit saying, "I'm Alan Livingston. I was president of Capital. I gave these to my son to do whatever he wants. These are the real deal." These Livingston butchers now can go, the monos were $30,000. And I think a stereo, if one went on sale, could probably easily bring $80,000 or more.
Wow.
So those are the ones you want. Now, are there Canadian butchers? Yes, there are. There are only a handful. I own a prototype. I know of another prototype. And by prototype, I mean it was a cover, fully done, but no record inside. Fairly recently, a real one came to light where someone who was a truck driver, and he was given a copy of them. What happened was they had to deliver them to the docks, then they had to rush them back, and this poor truck driver had driven there and then had to go back, and one of the guys said, "Hey, look, for your trouble, why don't you take one of these?"
Yeah.
So he actually had one. But the Canadian butcher is, of course, a lot rarer than the American butcher. We know of 3 copies of the cover now. There may be a few more, but not many.
Are there any differences between the Canadian and the American
butcher? Yeah, the Canadian ones are laminated. Mm. And they also have a Pars logo. The printer was Pars. So they have a little P on it. And it has Litho in Canada.
But same,
so, yeah, those are
same image, same layout, same fonts, even
absolutely.
Okay.
Oh yeah, they had to use the same Capital. They used the Capital artwork. The only difference was they did it laminated, and the paper I think might have been a different paper stock.
Did Canada also have that massive recall? Like in the U.S., I believe 60,000 or more were put in a landfill. Did a similar operation happen in Canada, or were they not that far along
in Canada?
In manufacturing?
Canada actually did. They would press albums in lesser numbers, so. In Canada, you might be looking at, maybe they pressed up 40 or 50,000 of them or something like that. And apparently those all were supposed to be destroyed and apparently were.
Are there any other geographies that had the butcher cover besides the U.S. and Canada?
No.
Okay.
It was Mexico was part of Capital. Capital had 2 subsidiaries. Capital is a subsidiary of EMI. They had Capital Records of Canada in Discos Capital de Mexico. And Discos Capital de Mexico usually got things a little bit later. Mm. So they had not done any butcher covers. So U.S. and Canada would be the only two markets. Now, did those pictures appear anywhere? Yeah, they did. John loved that picture so much that he wanted that to be used to promote the Beatles single, Paperback Writer. And in some of the music magazines, you actually see that an ad with that. The picture was in black and white. It was on the inside of a music magazine, and it didn't stir up the controversy that it did in the States, where it was, hey, front and center in color. Now, Disc and Echo magazine, which was partially owned by Brian Epstein, got an alternate color from the picture from the Butcher Session and put that on one of its issues and asked people to, hey, let us know what you think. And reaction came in about, I don't know, 50-50, and extremely negative. The negative was extremely negative. Mm-hmm. So, for you know, so people, it's wrong for them to say, oh, it was no big deal in England. People in England didn't care about it. No, they really did. Many people really were upset by it. This is pre-Alice Cooper Dead Babies, folks. So, you know, this was pretty shocking for 66. Honestly, it'd be it's shocking for 2020, to be perfectly candid.
It's certainly strange, even to this day. That must be the strangest Beatles photo session there ever was, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it truly was an adventure. Yeah. And, you know, the alternate pictures from it. And, you know, I was very fortunate to have interviewed Bob Whitaker. And he was very bitter because he had felt that, you know, Apple had taken the position that the work he did that he turned over to them was work for hire. And therefore, you know, he was paid for the session and no royalties and no nothing. Mm-hmm. However, Whitaker took the position that if I took a picture and I didn't give it to you, then it wasn't a work for hire. And I think he got sued, and, you know, it was a very bitter thing. But at the end of the day, Whitaker did keep some pictures, and he would from time to time sell them to people. When he died, his estate took over that archive, and I was able to get permission to use a lot of those images in the Capitol album's digital book. Mm. I didn't have those for the print edition. They are in the digital edition. And that alone makes that book worth the price of admission. If that was the only thing in the book, it would be well worth it. But there's a lot more in it, of course, than that, because I cover all of the Capitol albums from Meet the Beatles through Magical Mystery Tour in that book.
And I have to completely agree with you. The Beatles story on Capitol Records, people can check out a copy at beatle.net. And I got to tell you, Bruce, your books are by far some of the best investments I've ever made as a record collector, because the information that is contained in those books, not just the Capitol Records, but VJ and Swan and Parlophone, all the others, beautifully laid out, but highly, highly informative. So, yeah, I can't recommend it enough at beatle.net. The Capitol president, Alan Livingston, he saved a box of records. Were there any other batches here or there that survived somehow?
We're not aware of any massive batches like that. There were some promotional posters that were done for the album, and the album poster had the Butcher cover and then in red print with an explanation point above it. Incredible. To me, the incredible thing was that they ever did a promotional poster for those. Most of those were destroyed, but a batch of them survived, and there are a lot of fakes out there, but there are also real ones out there as well. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a cool item.
Yeah. And inside your book, I believe you talk about the differences of some of the different pressings. There's this, like you said, the Scranton, the Jacksonville, the Los Angeles. I believe the Los Angeles one is the most common. What are the rare ones? Is it the Jacksonville because all the covers were destroyed there?
Yeah, I mean, that would be my thinking. But honestly, you know, I'd have to flip through the book as far as which is going to be the rarest, because off the top of my head, the sealed Butcher covers from Capitol's Los Angeles factory, the stereo ones, there are about a dozen of those known to exist. So those are rare, but the Scranton ones are even rarer. The Scranton ones are only a few confirmed copies of those. So Scranton would be the rarest.
Got it. And the glues, there are different types of glues which make a variation in the ease of peelability. I'm not sure that yeah. I'm saying that right, but there's
I think that's right.
There's one plant that used a water soluble glue. There's another one that didn't, so it's harder to peel. So again, all this stuff is in Bruce's book, The Beatles, on Capitol Records at Beatle.net. Bruce, the legacy of the Butcher cover, the Beatles continued to reference it occasionally. We understand the story of John Lennon's Butcher from Dave Morrell and how that's been passed around. Are there any stories about the Beatles having Butcher covers?
John is the only one that we're really familiar with that story. Is it possible? I mean, look, if a mock-up of it was sent to London to take a look at, and it was only one, and they only would have sent one mock-up, John would have been the one who would have grabbed it and said, thanks, it's mine. And I don't think that the others would have won that argument. So, you know, that's probably the only mock-up that was done that way. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it really, you know, rare and cool. Some other fun facts with the Butcher thing. Brian Epstein was extremely worried and upset about this thing because Brian, and he confided in Tony Barrow, that he was worried that John and Paul would not forgive him and hold it against him for failing to get the cover out. And he was concerned about that. And when all was said and done, Tony Barrow remembers being in Brian's office, and Brian took the Butcher color transparency, held it up with one hand, and with the other hand lit a cigarette lighter and burnt the thing over an ashtray. And there are a lot of crazy stories out there about it. Now, how do you like irony? Here's the irony about the whole thing. Brian Epstein hated the Butcher image and never wanted it to see the light of day, much less be a cover. So when the Butcher cover comes out, Brian's job as the Beatles manager is to protect the Beatles. And Brian took the blame for the cover. It's pop art satire, and Brian basically took one for the team. A Canadian writer, Brian was the one, his idea, Brian Allport. And Brian is blamed in 1966 for the Butcher cover when he was the one who hated it the most. That's irony. Want even more irony? It really was Brian's fault. Why do I say that? Because Capitol had prepared an innocuous-looking trunk cover. And if Brian had not objected to that cover, that would have been the cover. And we, on June 15th, as scheduled, would have bought Yesterday and Today in a blue background cover that had the complete photo and the blue banner on the side with the Beatles in white and Yesterday and Today and all the song titles in yellow. And we would have had a 5-minute telephone conference where I would have talked about how they adapted it from the Yesterday picture sleeve. So the irony of it all is Brian hated the cover, tried to stop it, couldn't stop it, got blamed for it, but in the end it really was his fault, because he stopped the trunk cover from coming out. Once again, trunk, Butcher, trunk.
And Bruce, thank you so much for pulling us through that tale. Pictures and images of all these different states of Butcher cover, and I mean different states, even the mock-ups, the slicks, the test pressings, those sort of things are in Bruce's book.
And the very cool, very cool Bob Whitaker pictures that were not used. They're in there as well. Many of those are in there as well. And I had to pay a nice little licensing fee for that. So, but well worth every penny of the licensing fees, because they are such cool pictures.
So Bruce, I guess we're getting ready to wrap it up. Is there anything else that I should be asking about that I haven't?
Well, there was a lot of good music on that album. There were 11 really good Beatles songs on the album. The album topped the charts in the States, of course, and sold quite well. And also, in the United States, it was the second time this happened where you actually got a handful of Beatles songs earlier than fans anywhere else in the world. Long Tall Sally, you know, that had come out, you know, earlier in the States, and I Call Your Name on the Beatles' second album before they came out in EP form in England. And here you had I'm Only Sleeping in Dr. Robert and Your Bird Can Sing coming out in the States, you know, a full month and a half ahead of Revolver's release, and that would have been where you would have gotten it in the rest of the world. So those of us living in the U.S. and Canada had three Revolver tracks prior to anywhere else in the world. And any album that has all those great songs on it, it's not a bad listening experience. Is it what the Beatles intended? No. Nor was the Beatles' second album. But even people who hate what Capitol did will tell you the Beatles' second album is one of the greatest rock and roll albums ever made.
And so I got to say, I've got the original UK pressings of Beatles records. Those are the ones I tend to gravitate towards. And I've got a Butcher cover. The Butcher cover is one of the sonically worst sounding Beatles records I own. And I'm not sure why. I'm assuming it's because they're tapes of tapes or taken off safety copies or whatever. But
They were a tape of a tape. But bear in mind, too, on the Revolver tracks, if you have a stereo copy, what you're listening to on the Revolver tracks is what Capitol would call a duophonic. It's, you know, because Capitol, George Martin originally did mono mixes for those tracks that were going to be used in the UK. Capitol said, we need these songs. So George Martin sent them mono mixes. Capitol mastered the album quickly. Mm-hmm. And George Martin didn't realize they were going to master them immediately. And so he went ahead and made three stereo mixes for those songs. But Capitol had already cut like about, you know, 30 lacquers at that point, or masters, and they weren't about to recut them. And so even though Capitol later got true stereo mixes for those three Revolver songs, they used the duophonic. So that certainly takes away from the sound quality on those three tracks in particular. Now, on some of the tape versions, they actually used the stereo. And later pressings of the album, many years later, used the stereo.
Now, I know around this time there were reel-to-reels as well. Were there any Butcher reel-to-reels?
Yeah. No, there were no Butcher reels-to-reels. But there was, which is curious, is the 8-track. Remember 8-tracks? Mm-hmm. The 8-track for Yesterday and Today uses a variation of the blue trunk cover. And that's very cool. So the 8-track, if you have an original 8-track from that, that's what you would have had.
Oh, okay. And what's your collection like around Butcher memorabilia? There, I believe there's some promotional copies as well with promotion only stamped across the top.
There are some with that, yeah. Yeah, and those may have been done at the distributor level. I'm not aware of Butcher covers that have a stamped-in promo, although it's possible that some do exist, because anytime I say something doesn't exist, someone says, oh, I have one. But yeah, and, you know, I have, a First State stereo and a First State mono, and then I have Paystover stereo and Paystover mono. I have the prototype trunk cover with the silver background in my collection, and I have a blue trunk cover slick from Queens Litho. So that's what I personally have in my collection.
Oh, Bruce, you're making me very jealous. But again, everyone can check out all this material and heaps more in Bruce's book, The Beatles Story on Capitol Records. And again, if you go to Beatle.net, there's that book. There's also Beatles on Apple, Beatles on VJ, chock full of anecdotes and stories just like Bruce took us through. And of course, some books that deep dive into albums and other parts of the Beatles' amazing career. Physical books are available, but I reckon check out some of the digital editions. They're not only cheaper, but they're updated every so often with new material, new information. And since a lot of us are spending a lot of time indoors these days, you could be enjoying these books in a matter of minutes. Go to Beatle.net. And again, Bruce, thanks so much for coming back on the Vinyl Guide.
Glad to do it. Look, I'll be looking forward to coming back on where we can talk about the Let It Be project sometime later in the year.
Anytime. Anytime, Bruce.
You know what? It is always so fascinating to hear from Bruce. He has so much information on the band that we love and has impacted our lives so much. And if you've never been to Beatle.net, go there now. Check out Bruce's books. Download the digital versions. They are incredible. You'll be checking them out within minutes. I mean, it's that quick. And the amount of information and data that's in there, especially for record collectors, is unsurpassed. I've never seen this sort of detail really on any other artist by any other author focusing on records anywhere. So that's Beatle.net. Thank you very much, Bruce, and we're looking forward to having you back soon. That's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. If you are so blessed, please join our Patreon page. Become a show patron at patreon.com/vinylguide. I put early access to episodes up there, extended interviews, secret episodes, more information up there at patreon.com/vinylguide. Please join us if you can. That is much appreciated. If you're unable to, and I understand that many of you are, just please share these episodes on your social media and write us nice reviews on iTunes and the different sites that this show is available. That is much appreciated as well. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode, so until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.